Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel. It is Thursday, the 6th of March. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue, who is on a scheduled vacation. He should be back on Tuesday morning. I'm joined in studio this morning for the Roundtable panel by Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Please do keep your emails short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments. Don't use abbreviations that a live host may have a struggle interpreting as they cold read your letters. Proofread them if you have a chance, and let's not use any swear words. Thank you. Again, the email address is panel@wamc.org. Our music this morning is by Danu. They are playing Troy Savings Bank Music Hall on Friday. That's tomorrow night. TroyMusicHall.org, a traditional Irish band coming through in this season of luck. No. Guys, it just isn't. But it's about St. Patrick's Day, so they'll be through, and that will be great. We want to speak this morning quickly about, well, it doesn't have to be too quickly, but State Capitol radio reporter Karen DeWitt is getting a national honor from the Radio Television Digital News Association in Washington. Steve Barnes has written an article about it in the Times Union, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, is here and would like to also shout out and commend Karen.
Shout out to her. Karen, who just retired and will be going to Washington to get this, one of their First Amendment awards. And it's a big award. I mean, guys like Steve Inskeep from NPR and Leslie Stahl have received it. You know, she's at 60 Minutes. And it's a great recognition. And it underscores how important her work for four decades has been covering New York State Capitol for public radio and how that's continuing. You know, Ian Pickus has been a leader in the formation of this consortium of New York public radio stations. And they share their coverage, and it keeps accountability on the front burner for all of us, because they are a talented group, and they are and you have it here at WAMC, and it's WNYC, and it's all the other stations around the state contributing to this. And Karen was kind of the predecessor of all that, and it grew while she was there, and it's a great honor for her. She's a good reporter. In Steve Barnes's story specifically cites an incident back, I think it was in 2018 or 17, when she was covering Governor Andrew Cuomo.
December 2017.
Yeah, 17.
Yep.
And she was questioning him about the Me Too movement, and he was sort of being a bully to her, and she stood up to him, and she's about 5 feet, and he's around, you know, 6 feet something, and, you know, but she held her own, and she confronted him and persisted in questioning him, and it shows how important it is, not only on the federal level, which we'll be talking about, you know, the accountability that we need on a federal level, but you need it on state and local level, and how important your local and state news is, and how important your local newspapers are, and specifically how important your local public radio station is. So it's a great shout out for Karen, and she'll be going to Washington and getting this award, and that's a terrific thing. Oh, and she writes a column occasionally for the Times Union, so check it out.
So you can find that article in the Times Union or at thetimesunion.com. And we, of course, miss Karen, but 40 years is long enough to try to do this job. You are permitted to retire.
Yeah, it's a change when you no longer have a deadline like that.
Indeed. Let us discuss President Trump's tariff reprieve for the auto industry. This will be the first major story we discuss this morning, and we'll try to get a lot of them in because there's a lot going on. Less than 48 hours after slapping tariffs on all goods from Canada and Mexico, President Donald Trump agreed to a one-month reprieve for automobile imports that qualify for duty-free treatment under the North American Trade Agreement negotiated during his first term. The president's decision followed a phone conversation with executives from the big three automakers, General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis, who sought relief from the new import taxes. Each of the automakers over the past several decades have developed complex supply chains that cross North American borders multiple times before delivering a finished product, which is something we've been mentioning frequently as we've discussed these tariffs on the show the last week or two. Along with disrupting those supply chains, Trump's tariffs would have increased the cost of a typical new car by more than $10,000, the industry groups said. Asked if Trump expected automakers to be able to relocate production in the next month, Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said yes. Automakers could begin planning potential production moves and communicating those changes to their suppliers within that 30-day window, assuming that there is idle capacity at an existing plant in the United States. Some work could shift from a Canadian or Mexican plant within the next several months. Those possible successes in moving manufacturing to U.S. put into words by Bill Hurls, a retired auto industry supply chain executive with 38 years experience. We should note he did have, you know, a lot of qualifications in the success of that possibility, assuming there's an idle plant, etc. But any short-term production could be limited by union contracts. A manufacturer's commitments to local governments may have offered tax breaks and suppliers' capacity. So, a rather tumultuous time in the auto industry and every industry. Who would like to begin talking about this one? Mark.
Yeah, hi. This is Mark Whitman.
Thank you for being here. I guess I did just introduce you guys and not say hello. Hello. Yeah.
Hello.
Happy.
So, I've been thinking a lot about Trump's tariffs and how much destruction they will rain down on our economic system and in our political standing in the world. And I want to start with basic principles. I think some of the initial warnings about how damaging tariffs are were overdone by people in the news media who heard economists say something and then took it to an extreme. If you think about a system in which countries trade effectively amongst one another and the system benefits all, there are basically two extremes that explain how it can work. One extreme is if everyone in the trading system has about equal power and they work things out cooperatively amongst themselves. The other extreme is if there's a dominant player who can basically impose restrictions on everybody else, but does so in a way that maximizes free trade and therefore maximizes the benefit to all the participants. The other option for that dominant player, and frankly in simplified terms in the global markets, the United States is the dominant player, is for that dominant player to use its power and to dial back on the free trade dial and increase their own share of the aggregate pie. And frankly, that's what Trump is after. If he gets his way, and if he did it in a very logical, methodical, careful way, some of what the economists have said would happen wouldn't be so bad. There likely will be an increase in costs, i.e. inflation, but that's a one-time increase, at least of the way we measure inflation in this country. We probably would bring some jobs back to the United States, and we probably would lose a little bit of our political clout in the world. But we've already – so now we go to the real-world case. The United States and other countries don't practice pure free trade. There are plenty of tariffs. And as a matter of fact, the rest of the world tends to use tariffs more than we do. So we have been the good guy with the – we've been the good operator with the power to put down that hammer to our own benefit. We've never used it. Is it a surprise that Donald Trump picks up that – you know, looks at that shiny potential hammer and says, I'd like to use this, right, at the expense – of geopolitical cooperation in order to maximize the economic well-being of my populace. But the other problem with Donald Trump is anytime he picks up a hammer, he wields it like a toddler. And this particular case of having now to backtrack on the auto tariffs is a perfect example. It would take somewhere between 18 months to 2 years at a minimum. If the United States just decided, look, for national security reasons, we want to produce our own cars, full stop, or at least as much of it as is humanly possible, it would take a tremendous amount of time and care to get to that state of economic affairs. And so our favorite toddler with this hammer is bringing damage onto the economy, not only because he's sub-optimizing the theory of optimal trade between countries, but probably even more so in real costs because of the capricious an emotional way in which he's yielding this power. And I think it's important when you sort through what's happening and what you read about it to be a little skeptical of some sort of the absolute economic declarations of how bad tariffs are, but to be very acutely aware of the cost of these frictions that Donald Trump and his administration are bringing on us in real economic terms.
Mike?
Yeah, it's hard to follow something like that, but I'll try.
Thank you.
I mean, what is the goal here? I mean, is the goal really to bring all components of manufacturing automobiles back within the borders of the U.S.? Because I think that if that were to happen, the European car makers, the Chinese car makers, the Japanese, Korean car makers would all eat our lunch. They would be able to deliver cars during that transition at a more competitive price, and it would not help the big three, so to speak, whatever that means anymore, you know. But it wouldn't help the big three automakers in the end. And the deal, I mean, the USMCA, the trade deal with Mexico and Canada that Trump himself brokered, would be broken by this. It's going to, I don't know, it looks like chaos. To me, this 30-day reprieve is probably going to be followed by some announcements by the big three that they're beginning that transition you referenced, Mark. You know, we're identifying, we've opened negotiations with the unions, we're identifying space within our factory, surplus factory areas, and we're going to start that transition. And whether it even really ever happens is less important than Trump saying, okay, then we're going to hold back and we're not going to tax you during that transition, and then it'll just go away, and there'll be other carve-outs, I'm sure, for other industries along the way, too. And Trump will have the appearance of having imposed these, you know, these tariffs that are punitive in so many ways, and yet little by little they'll have less impact. We'll make a deal with, Justin Trudeau, and we'll make a deal with Mexico, and it won't have as much impact as maybe the economists worry about, but it'll allow Trump to save face. This is what I think is going to happen.
Nick?
Hi, this is Nick.
Hi, Nick.
I'm supposed to say, by the way, that my opinions are my own.
Okay.
Yes.
They don't represent the position of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York.
Surprisingly, Lazny does not have a position on tariffs. Okay. So, if you were to believe that the purpose of the tariffs is to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., there is some evidence that some of that is happening a little bit, or might be able to sort of reengage in some of those. I think they're being described as just idle manufacturing facilities, but hiring and training and upstarting whole portions of a manufacturing supply line is expensive and it's time consuming, and it would take a while. And in the meantime, the price of those vehicles will go up, and there is no universe where prices go that far back down. So we will just forever be paying substantially more for vehicles, even if they're made in the U.S. There are some really interesting questions around labor shortages in the U.S., union protections, and what that looks like in this environment, and where these locations would be. We know it's difficult to open new manufacturing plants in some areas and regions where there are human beings who could work in them. I think those things are really complicated. And as Mark said, you have this hammer, and a hammer doesn't solve those really complicated nuances in the supply chain development. The other thing that's sort of like woven in here is, and that I'm just kind of curious about in a philosophical way, is we know that certain industries are just in favor with this administration. And we do know that certain very wealthy donors are able to pay for time at dinners with the president. We used to call them bribes. We know that happens. And it's curious, where are the manufacturing billionaires? Like, what are they doing behind the scenes? And what do those conversations look like? Because they are taking a hit by having to, like, come back to the U.S. and pay U.S. wages, right? Like, there is actually a cost to manufacturing, to increasing those wages and being here in the U.S. So I'm just kind of watching as these pieces kind of land in that big hammer.
A very well-raised point that we will discuss after news from the BBC. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. The panel this morning, Nick Rangel, Mike Spain, and Mark Whitman. And we will be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and for Joe Donahue, until next Tuesday when he'll return, joined in studio by Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. Jeremy writes in and adds to the conversation that tariffs will not create more U.S. manufacturing jobs. It will only speed up the inevitable transition to automation. Also something to discuss. But doesn't it seem like Nick was saying before the break, all of these things, you can't just turn on a light switch and a factory is working, even if it did work before. There's, you know, repairs, staffing, et cetera. And then the, you know, transition to automation would, of course, be very technical and time-consuming, one would think. Discuss, panel.
Well, I mean, you also have to realize why those factories closed and why these jobs moved overseas. And there's so many dynamics to that. And to, you just can't pick it up and bring it back and expect it not to be an enormous cost. And as you said, Sarah, I mean, you don't just go in and start. If you were going to build a factory to make widgets, you wouldn't make them the way you would have made them in the 1990s. You would make them in a much different way. Most of it would be automated, and it would use contemporary technology. And that doesn't roll out without a lot of bumps. It's a tough transition. And then, and what will it achieve? It won't make, if the cars really do cost, do you think that's a fair and accurate estimate, $10,000 more? Yeah, I mean,
Should anger some bases.
Yeah.
Citizens,
I mean, if an
American-made
car
side
is just out of the gate going to cost $10,000 more, then, that is not going to make American cars more competitive. They'll probably only be sold in the U.S. And then, you know, you have your Korean and your Japanese companies that are making cars in the U.S., and they won't be affected by this. They can go and make them the way that they currently make them. And it's not a very happy prospect for the auto industry.
Mark?
Jeremy gets a gold star for the day.
The letter writer.
Yep. He's
Jeremy, we're going to catch up to you.
Well, I think to say that onshoring production in the United States may not lead to as many job gains as you would first suspect is correct for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're a higher rate labor environment, and as a result, manufacturers trade off automation for labor. And if you want to see a great example of that, there was a cartoon I saw years ago when McDonald's, well, I shouldn't have mentioned the corporate name, but when many fast food chains were putting in those order your own kiosks.
Yes.
And it said, welcome to your new minimum wage, which is a harsh comment, but it does highlight the trade-off that Jeremy's talking about. Additionally, we're near a full employment economy as an economy as a whole. Now, that's different than saying every region is enjoying that. But it does raise the issue that in order to get people to do something that used to be done in Canada, many times you'll have to draw them away from other jobs, which further increases wage rates. So the other thing I really like about Jeremy's letter is it starts to question, well, what are the knock-on effects of all these things? And Nick was doing that as well when she talked about when she started talking about retaliation from others and political campaigns or political lobbying, which then becomes a very inefficient exercise in a country. Because what you see, for instance, last time around with Trump tariffs, the retaliation was against the agricultural sector. And then Trump put, I think I remember the number, it was, well, the range, it was billions of dollars of subsidies in place for farmers because they were being hurt in the short run by these tariffs. Now, Trump has said recently, well, you better just get ready to sell the agricultural sector in the United States. You get ready to sell lots of food in the U.S. But I doubt many people are going to rip out soybean fields and successfully put in avocado trees in the Midwest. And again, that highlights the sort of inefficiencies that once you start...
The climate hasn't changed that much.
Yeah, once you start an imbroglio like this. Now, the one thing I will say is, in terms of retaliatory tariffs, we are boxing against T-Rex. I mean, we are such a huge net importer that when people threaten us to tariff our exports, it actually is a punch that can't land as effectively. You saw that very quickly when you saw what Trump did with Colombia, because there are plenty of substitutes for Colombian coffee, and the Colombian president figured that out really quickly and decided, yeah, you can send those plane loads of folks that are allegedly in your country illegally back to us. So again, I think just to highlight, taking a step back from sort of the hyperventilation that the press does because it's easy, and thinking about all the knock-on effects is the right way to think about what's happening here.
Do we think that these CEOs or other CEOs will have the power or the exercise or the influence to make some of these tariffs go away wholesale?
Yeah, clearly some of them will and some of them won't. And the inefficient thing becomes now departments will have – now corporations will place a lot of focus on lobbying the government because that in some cases is going to be a more productive activity than making sure your factory runs smoothly in terms of – productive in terms of what it yields for shareholders. So once you start to open up this can of worms, they start to crawl everywhere, and we're already starting to see that by virtue of the very fact that the three heads of the automakers got on a phone call with Trump and got this reversed. This can't be the only case where the tariff is going to significantly increase costs and disadvantage the United States, but it is a case where because of their size and visibility, the corporations got to the White House first.
Yeah, I think because it's such a big hammer, it's really easy to kind of layer this overall increase in tariffs and then piecemeal make deals with individual leaders in specific manufacturing or development fields or arenas. So, like, if you take Apple, for example, that's been resistant to some of the administration's initiatives. Does this now give the administration more leverage to persuade Apple to shift its tone on those issues? And I think you'll see just everyone kind of either lining up or not lining up and taking the hit. But I think each of them will go in succession and knock on Trump's door and say, hey, okay, here's what we're willing to do to try to get out of the negative or the most damaging impact of these policies.
It's the art of the deal, isn't it? Isn't that what it's called? It'll create a transactional situation where Trump will and he trades on optics. A lot of the results of these conversations will be that they'll be demonstrating their fealty to Trump and his policies publicly, and he'll be beaming with credit, and then he'll like I said, he'll do carve-outs, for various places. And he won't do carve-outs for everybody because some won't bend down on their knee for him. And we saw what happened last week when Zelensky wouldn't get down on his knee and kiss the ring. I mean, it's all about optics. He wants it to look good.
It's not only – I think the Zelensky parallel, by the way, is really effective here. This is about the perception of short-term economic gain at the expense of long-term economic and geopolitical costs. And Trump is entirely incapable, and his administration have proven themselves incapable of accurately assessing the cost of that trade-off. They are far too short-term and optically focused to get it right. And that's what we're seeing.
Reactionary and impulsive.
Well, I think also he has such limited power in the policy-making realm that the only power he really can yield is in the big hammer swings. And I think he's using the power that he knows he has instead of investing the effort into building the power he knows he doesn't have.
I think that's really good, too, because it underscores why, even though I could probably fit in my backpack the amount of fentanyl that's come from Canada, he's using that as an excuse to tuck the tariffs in under emergency laws or regulations that permit him to do this.
Well, and then both Canada and Mexico sent more troops to their borders, more forces to their borders to try to prevent fentanyl from crossing, to inspect more bags and things as that goes through cars, and he didn't care.
Yeah, and by the way, if you wanted to really talk about solving fentanyl, Sheinbaum has made reference, Claudia Sheinbaum, the president of Mexico, has made reference to the fact that it's a demand issue, yeah, not a supply issue, because I guarantee you, if somehow you hermetically sealed our northern and southern borders, that the demand would still lead to that product, particularly given how small and lethal it is, coming in through elsewhere. So, again, my point was it's that is just an excuse. Nick's point was he's using what tools he has, and unfortunately, some of them are big hammers as opposed to sort of policy scalpels, because that he doesn't have. I mean, may not get that power during his tenure. And that explains why he's using this false pretense. What I don't fully understand, it puzzles me, is I don't understand why this isn't being brought to court, because anybody could look at the fallacious claims he's making about why he's doing this, particularly with respect to Canada, and just say this isn't an emergency. The court has to stop this. I'm puzzled as to why that's not taking place.
It might be difficult to find the individual who can carry a claim and have standing. Like, I think there's some complications around who would bring that and how they would and in what jurisdiction. But that's just my guess. I think it is unfair to assume that the newly elected president of Mexico wasn't planning to and wasn't going to tackle fentanyl in her own country without our president going and telling her what to do. And there's this narrative that, like, Mexico did what Trump wanted because of the threat of tariffs, without really acknowledging that the new president of Mexico ran on a campaign that was going to tackle cartel activity. And she is, in fact, doing that. And there's not evidence she would not have done that but for these tariffs. And it is an interesting, like, lens that Americans have that is so just centralized on American activity and not outward looking to, like, other countries' own autonomy as, like, full-grown adults.
David writes in to panel at WAMC.org and said, missing in this conversation is the simple fact that this country doesn't have the raw materials to build automobiles. We would have to re-engage massive mining and processing, and even then we don't have a lot of the metals and materials that are needed to manufacture a whole host of parts. We live in a global market, to your point. Trying to close the doors will simply leave us isolated and less powerful. Seeing no disagreement, we will take an underwriting break and return with a new topic, I think, after this. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Our music this morning is by Danu. They are playing Troy Savings Bank Music Hall tomorrow night. TroyMusicHall.org for more information. And the playlist is posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuc. I'm your host of The Roundtable this morning. And I'm joined by Nick Rangel, Mike Spain, and Mark Whitman. We want to talk about a new story. This is conservative media figures are calling on President Trump to pardon former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted in the 2020 murder of George Floyd. The it's being discussed in the media, it's being posted about on social media, and we wanted to talk about it and around it this morning. Not around it, about it. Mark, would you like to begin?
Yeah, I saw this story last night, and then I heard it on CNN, and it made eating dinner hard. I think it's important we not give any credence to this in practical terms, because if you recall, Derek Chauvin was first convicted in state court in Minnesota and then pled guilty to, I believe, a civil rights violations in federal court. So even if he were pardoned in that bizarro world, he would still serve the state sentence, which is at least as long as the federal sentence, if my recollection is correct. What I find most troubling is that a representative of the White House, Elon Musk, retweeted this to his millions of followers. I think it highlights, Musk's continued display of poor decision, racism, a emphasis on roiling the waters, even at the expense of different parts of our country. And I think the White House needs to be responsible for it, be held responsible for it in terms of the condemnation. And I think the condemnation should come from all quarters. It also, when I first heard it, I thought to myself, this is a trap. If you're the administration and you want to get people out into the streets and bait them into a response and then have a counter reaction to that, this would be perfect. I mean, the actual pardon would be perfect. I'd wait till, you know, the July 4th weekend or week. I'd do it during the summer, you know, all I'd do the right thing. And I would see if I couldn't set the streets alight throughout this country. And then I would crack down, as Trump is wont to do. It also raises to me the issue of, I wouldn't put it past the administration to try something like this, both in anticipation of the midterms and in anticipation of 4 years from now, the next presidential election. I just think that's something that civil rights groups, groups on the left, frankly, even reasonable, everybody who's a reasonable person in this country needs to start thinking about. If some trap were to be set, how would we respond so as to not play into the hands of the Republicans? And I'll tell you one thing, particularly given that ridiculous display we saw at President Trump's speech. It's clear there's no Democratic leadership to help us navigate our way through this right now.
Mike or Nick?
Yeah. Well, it's important to underscore that Minnesota's own laws will keep former officer Chauvin in prison despite a federal pardon. But the symbolism of the federal government saying and reversing his conviction for violating the civil rights of George Floyd by murdering him, is palpable. That would be a tragic thing to witness. But it actually doesn't seem like it's beyond reality, and that's just stunning to me. I mean, it's part of the problem, and Trump is very good at this. He's great at saying very hyperbolic things that makes people on the opponents to his positions go nuts, basically, and lose their cool and say very harsh rhetorical things about him. And he likes that because it divides people even more, or it pushes them into doing what the Democrats we watched on TV the other night at the state at his address before the joint sessions of Congress, Trump's address, just quietly sitting on their hands or holding up little signs saying false, false, that kind of thing, and they're not stepping up. So either way, it works for Trump. That either made them quiet and they're not saying anything, or they're just flying off the handle. I've touched their buttons and everything, and really it takes some more complicated way to deal with the Trump situation. I mean, when he talks about cutting waste in government, who who could disagree that there's waste in government? And there's systematic ways to search that out and look for ways to end that. And other administrations have had great success doing that. Others have had less success doing it. But just burning the house down and selling all the buildings, which including the Leo O'Brien office building in Albany, which was briefly on the market for resale yesterday, where all our federal offices are and all our congressional and Senate offices are in Albany and serving the Capital Region. You know, instead of that, coming up with a systematic approach to look for and identify ways to be more efficient and consolidate in that way. And you know, he has some basis in reality for some of the actions that he's doing, and then he just makes it, he pours gasoline on it and lights the fire, and he achieves this remarkable result of either shutting people down or creating more division.
Well, I mean, there is a constant, like, flood the zone narrative. And so, like, my day-to-day life today is looking through the, you know, the many, like, all the puzzle pieces thrown on the floor and being like, okay, which one actually has an impact on what, you know, is in my field or in what's most important to, like, the work that we do, right? But in this scenario, and I do think Mark is right, and a lot of this is like a baiting moment, but I'm not sure that it's a summer baiting moment, and only because this week there was also the tweet that any college that allows a protest would be defunded at the federal level. We know that many of the people who I'm not going to say I know for a fact, but I suspect that a lot of the people who showed up for the mass demonstrations following the killing of George Floyd, who were college students, probably rely on federal student aid, which is in the purview of the Department of Education. We also know this week that Trump is planning on trying to dismantle the Department of Education. And so you have these things that sort of coalesce or come together. Is there a moment where he wants to kind of trigger a reaction on colleges to trigger these protests, to provide an excuse to defund either specific students who participate by canceling federal student aid, or defund colleges that allow protests and the expression of speech on public properties? That's sort of the analysis that I go through every day these days. You know, it's quite the brain exercise, but
what a pleasant way of putting it. Quite the brain exercise.
Yeah.
This is good. I know it's nice.
It's like some hot yoga.
Nice framing.
And so, yeah, I am curious about, you know, the real intent, because it's not like they're buddies, right? Like it's a little bit different than releasing the people that he thinks were there for him as his like partners in, you know, making America great. I'm sorry, right. That hurt a little bit.
Yes, it sounded like it did.
But you know, this is like, who's even thinking about this guy right now? Like, why are we digging into that you know, basket?
Tracy writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, I think Mr. Whitman is 100% correct in his assessment that this is a trap to get protesters in the streets so that maybe Trump and Hegseth can engage the military to handle them. What a disgrace our country is becoming. Do we want to comfort Tracy that she's thinking too fatalistically or no?
No.
Mark is shaking his head. Nick is
shaking his head. No, although, Nick, I think you're right. I mean, it would be effective now in the effort to defund colleges and punish college campuses where protests happen and punish college students who participate in protests if it were to bring out protests. So it'll be effective now. It'll be effective in the summer. It'll be effective in the months before Trump's term is supposed to end in a few years.
I mean, will be mass protests this summer. I think that's pretty clear. Not like it just feels obvious. And, you know, there are organizations that are already sort of gearing up and training more people, more attorneys, more support for what those protests are going to look like. And I think this is signaling that this administration is also gearing up and is also preparing for, you know, pretty intense activities.
I just worry that there's not effective leadership that's going to help channel opposition when and if the administration does something intentionally or otherwise that would cause a very severe and broad reaction in this country. I don't think this becomes that provocation unless and until there's an actual pardon. I don't know if this is the ticket. I think this is on Musk, and I think under any normal circumstances, Musk would now be ejected from the administration. Under any other previous administration, save the Trump one, I think it points out the fact that those of us in opposition, better not lean into the left hook when they throw it, and we now lack the leadership to help us do that, and so we need to be extra careful.
Join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. It is time now for a regional news break with WAMC's own Ray Graff, and we will return after that. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org, and we are now going to speak about recent news about the Department of Veterans Affairs. This coverage from the New York Times. The Department of Veterans Affairs is planning to reduce its workforce by more than 80,000 people, according to a memo seen by the New York Times, outlining part of President Trump's escalating efforts to slash the federal bureaucracy. The memo, first reported by the trade publication Government Executive, calls for the department's workforce to go from more than 482,000 workers as of late last year to 399,957. Some of those cuts could be made by offering early retirement or severance payments, but earlier efforts to entice employees to quit their jobs voluntarily fell short of the Trump administration's stated goal to drastically reduce the size of the federal workforce. Administration officials then fired tens of thousands of workers across the federal government. Doug Collins, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, released a video statement on Wednesday announcing the cuts, saying, as he has previously, that health care services and benefits would not be cut under the Trump administration and that 300,000 positions at the department had been labeled mission critical to ensure that services would not be interrupted. If that mission critical designation remains, the cuts would have to come from a pool of about 182,000 workers, eliminating more than 40% of the non-critical workforce at the department. Nick.
Yeah, so this, just as a disclosure, both my parents and both my step-parents were in the military, and so VA issues have come up over the years. My brother-in-law and all my uncles, we're like a military family.
Right.
And so this particular cut, I think, is pretty deeply felt, obviously, among veterans, where more than 25% of the VA is staffed by veterans. But also because VA service has always been a struggle. They've never been an agency that was well-staffed. It's never been able to meet the need of the veterans, particularly, the Vietnam veterans as they aged, having less and less access to VA services because the cost of those services have increased, right? And then now with Iraq and Afghanistan veterans having larger needs as they age as well. And so this cut to return staffing levels to pre-2019, when from many people's perspective, the growth in the VA was a success and was a win because that had been what was being asked and demanded of the system for decades, really feels like a huge step back. But I do also recall that there have been efforts to privatize VA medical services, and there is a real threat here that as we cut service provided by the federal government, there is going to be this gap that I do suspect will be contracted out to private parties. And, that's the trail of the dollars that I think we need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, a spokesperson for the you know, for the Department of Veterans Affairs, put it this way. Every dollar we spend on wasteful contracts, non-mission critical duplicative activities is one less dollar we can spend on veterans. And given the choice, we will always side with veterans. And that'll be the mantra. They'll say that it's full of waste and full of non-critical, duplicative, and just unnecessary costs. We're going to cut all that. And that's been pretty much the message in other major staffing cuts for other agencies that have have been implemented by DOGE, you know, the Elon Musk-headed organization that is not really a department but is acting like one. And I think you're right, Nick. I think that the it's going to force a collapsing of the current system and force outsourcing, and that is the intention. That's the intention, I think, with other, with Medicaid, Medicare, certainly, and with Social Security. Well, I mean, right now they're looking at, not taking the steps to shore up Social Security, and there's been many recommendations on how that could happen. And when it starts to collapse and break down and people start complaining, it'll fuel the future scenario where they'll propose privatizing Social Security again. Why don't you take that money and you're giving to Social Security and invest it? And then when you retire, you'll have more money. Well, that will work great for the people who can afford to do that, but for the others who don't do that, they'll be in poverty in their old age. And that was why Social Security was invented, so that we could take care of our people, and that becoming elderly was not the equivalent of becoming impoverished. I mean, it's happening to the VA, it's happening all over, and it's basically burning down the house and forcing this away from government into private hands.
Mark.
So the cuts that we're talking about now are 15% of the workforce, and the Washington Post, anyway, states that that the objective is to get the workforce down to 400,000 people within the VA, which would bring it back to where it was in 2019. If this were a company in an industry that I cover, and they said they were undergoing this efficiency exercise. I actually would think it wasn't an unreasonable objective to go back to 2019 personnel levels and still provide the same level of service. It actually be pretty normal in a lot of industries, given all the gains through automation that have been available. The problem with this is I don't think that DOGE coders are helping the people at the VA write programs that are making them more efficient. What a sad, in a way, what a lost opportunity here. I do think it's the case that Trump and the DOGE folks are in the midst of what I'll call a state capture. And I think Nick highlights something, which is two things on the right. If these cuts either A, break the system, or B, force it into more privatization, I don't think they care. On the break the system, let's talk about that just for a little bit. One of the ways, if care is too expensive, you don't have enough money, what do? You ration care. You slow down the rate at which people get it so you don't have to spend as much money in any one period. And if the system starts to buckle, that's what you'll do. And I think the right's perfectly happy to do that in this case. I also think I heard something from Ezra Klein yesterday talking about the speech to the joint houses of Congress and how Trump started to set up the Social Security argument about the people being paid even though they're 114 years old. And J.D. Vance and Mike Johnson know better in terms of what's really happening. But, you know, the issue is on the right. And I think this comes true with the VA and these claims that, we're just going to be more efficient. We're going to do this like corporations would. You know, those people basically sold their souls to this guy politically and really morally. And they're so invested now. There's only one way out, which is to hope that either he's truly successful or that they can applaud and cheer loudly enough so that he looks successful and therefore the actions that they personally have taken to facilitate him are somehow justified by that success. So you see this sort of this malicious cycle, basically, in which once your moral compass is gone, Trump's the only place it points, and he has to be successful. And if he's not successful, let's at least be able to claim he's successful. And I fear that with the VA, and we may talk about this later, but with the elimination or intended elimination of the Department of Education, that's what we're seeing. And then the regrettable thing is here, if Elon Musk and his team of musketeers all said, hey, we're going to go in and, you know, the government's still using cobalt and all these systems from decades ago that doesn't work. We're going to go in and help these people do it better. And even we're going to fire some once we've done that because the remainder are more efficient. That would be very different and sort of attacked more akin to what people do in the corporate world, because there is a responsibility in terms of corporate profits at the end of the day that the government doesn't have. Unfortunately, that's not what we're seeing.
Shouldn't have. Well, isn't supposed to have.
It's not about,
shouldn't.
Yeah, but it's not about profit. But you're right. I think you make a good point. I mean, certainly many industries have had to face cutbacks and had to come up with ways to eliminate staff. But when ordinarily, when it's done and it's regrettable, but when it's downsizing is necessary in a company, they have to look at what they absolutely need, and they look for ways of efficiency. They get people involved in the process. Some people take, incentivized departures, buyouts, as they call them. Some people might get incentives to retire early. And it's a process that people participate in. What's happened now, and it just must be devastating to be a federal employee, getting these emails from, Elon Musk, basically, that ask you what you did last week. Name five things that you accomplished last week. When they get this, now you have these federal employees who are sitting at the edge of their chair, who rather than worrying about the work they have to do and the job they have to do, they're worrying about their job. It's unsettling. It's just, you know, it's unsettling if any company is going through cutbacks and facing possible layoffs for employees. But this is, they have been demonized. They have been publicly, thrown off the payrolls. And then yesterday, what did we read? We read that the Department of Agriculture has to hire a bunch of people back. The CDC has to hire a bunch of people back.
And they send another email that says, read this immediately.
Yeah.
You're come
but
back
some
to
of
work.
The people can't
it's
get
so
into the email that they've been locked out of
odd.
To hire them back. I mean, it is chaos. And it's there's a better. I mean, during the Bill Clinton administration, Al Gore was in charge of the program. You may remember Reinvent the Government. They went through and they brought about efficiencies, but it was systematic. It wasn't pleasant. It may have gotten rid of some things that people did cherish, but it was done systematically because the federal government, to sit here and say the federal government isn't bloated, doesn't have some grotesque inefficiencies around, is probably a lie. I mean, there is inefficiencies when you have something in the trillions like that.
Of course there is.
But when you look at the level of it compared to the size of it, like in Social Security, how many people are really getting Social Security at the age of 118? None. They basically, if the system doesn't have a firm birth date on somebody, they investigate it, and while they investigate it, they attach a date in the 1800s so that it stands out in their old antiquated cobalt-based system that Mark was talking about. It's a way to go filter all these ones that we have to check out. But it doesn't mean that there's these people between 118 and 148 years old getting checks. And that's a complicated answer to a argument that Trump makes, rhetorically, that carries a, that people hear and say, wow, that's terrible. But there's an explanation. There usually is.
Nick?
Yeah, thanks. So I want to take a minute and just actually review what does the VA do? Because over 6% of Americans are veterans, and those veterans all have families. Those veterans and families all have entitlement benefits that are supposed to be provided through the VA, the Veterans Affairs Department, right? And those benefits include disability compensation, pensions, and survivor support, education opportunities and vocational training, home loans for veterans, insurance, life insurance, burial services, and the medical centers. If you're a veteran, you have a benefit of TRICARE. TRICARE covers you and your direct dependents. Under TRICARE, you are required to use a VA medical center for your healthcare services if you are within 50 miles of the center or 100 miles of an approved provider, whatever the criteria is.
Right.
And what we are seeing with the cut in staffing levels at the department is a cut in staffing levels at those medical centers as well. And we've seen reports that job posts for nurses and medical professionals for VA medical centers have been pulled down off of USA Jobs and have been frozen out since January already. We know that the total impact of that will mean less access for veterans and their families to go to the doctor. And like that should matter. These are people who have served our country honorably. These are people who have fought on the front lines. These are folks who have injuries because of their service. And we know that we've expanded benefits to people who are impacted by burn pits in the Middle East, and that those injuries, those diseases, those cancers, those illnesses are severe, lifelong, and permanent. We know that we were stationed at Camp Lejeune during the water contamination. Mm-hmm. And we know now that more and more people were impacted by those contaminated bases, and you know, whole like families live here. They're like whole cities. And the idea that we're just like, oh, it's just efficiency, it's just to save taxpayer dollars is offensive and should be very upsetting to everybody.
The other thing,
thank you, Nick.
The other thing I think we have a problem with is at both the policy level and, if you will, the functional level, the Trump administration is making working for the government a sucker's bet. At the, am I allowed to say that on
sure.
public radio?
Yeah. That's all right.
Yes, I believe you just did. Yes.
Okay. At the policy level, if you happen
you didn't
to
see me whiplash to the dumb button, you're okay. The right, ones that you can't say are pretty triggering for me.
If
In the studio.
If you're at the Department of Justice or the FBI or somewhere else and you're assigned to investigate wrongdoing, and it turns out the next administration decides that that wasn't really wrongdoing and they take umbrage with that investigation, you're fired. Right? And by the way, that's going to have that hypothetically could happen when the Democrats get in office. So who wants to sign up for that office? Talk to me about there will always be exceptions to people who are dedicated to this country. But talk to me generally about the quality of people you're going to get generally under those circumstances.
I absolutely agree.
And then let's talk about the functional level.
It's gone.
Well, what is an organization, right? An organization is a group of people that come together to accomplish a common purpose. What glee does our current administration take in quote-unquote putting USAID through the quote-unquote wood chipper, right? If public employees are the enemies, how long will it take before somebody deciding between two job offers decides that they'd really rather not work for an employer that's going to consider them the enemy in certain circumstances? So I just think, again, I think this is Trump and his folk trying to maximize economic – really, this isn't the economic side of the cake, by the way. I want everybody to focus on that. This isn't where the money is. The money is on the entitlements. This is state capture and fireworks for display. And so who wants to be the victim of that type of treatment? And if you don't want to be, what does that say about who we're going to attract to be in our government beyond this administration? It's really sad to think about the long-term effects of what we're seeing now.
Yeah, but it is, to use the term I used before, it's the optics of it, the appearance that we're going after the waste and the people who don't do anything and the government agencies that don't accomplish anything, and we're gonna stop all that. At the same time, you have the House of Representatives passing a bill that's going to give a $4.5 trillion tax cut, primarily affecting the most wealthy in this country. And even though no, I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that the cuts that are going on by DOGE are pennies compared to the dollars that a tax cut like that would be. It's going to become the justification for that. So the hypocrisy of saying we're going to cut all this, all these programs, all these things that people have relied on. We're gonna remove this safety net for our veterans who fought on the front lines for us, and we're going to now turn around and create an extraordinary debt that we're going to be our children's children's children will be paying off by giving a big chunky bonus to those those wealthy people. It's preposterous.
John writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, as a technologist, I can assure you that COBOL, while an old language, is certainly not an antiquated language. Neither is it an arcane language. For-profit businesses still use COBOL, and the two-digit year field elimination was overcome decades ago. The fact is that Elon Musk is not in any way whatsoever a technologist. He's a con man. And his code broke our kids who don't have the knowledge or experience to address anything but the most recent innovations in technology. That from John.
I personally want to apologize to all programmers who use COBOL. I didn't mean to COBOL.
Yeah.
I keep putting the T on it, right? That lets you know where I'm coming from. But it is. There have been newer databases since then that are more robust.
We have a couple of minutes before a news break. I want to read this letter, which kind of encapsulates some of the feedback that the panel is getting as to routes where we should send our discussion. So let us raise this. John says, spending your time discussing the effects of having elected an unstable, deranged megalomaniac to the White House is, as they say, like arranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Maybe spend a little more time each day getting to the real problem in this country. Hint, the corporations. For example, we have the ADA, the AMA, the insurance companies and drug companies working tirelessly to keep universal health care out of America, the banks and the LLCs pushing the housing crisis, income inequality that is stunning and is only going to get worse. The blame goes squarely to the so-called Democrats who abandoned the working class and middle class. This setup is the real source of massive discontent, which allows clowns and grifters to take over.
I mean, we don't elect the corporations, right? We elect people into office. And so the conversation, from my perspective, is always on the shoulders of the people responsible for allowing corporations to act the way corporations are designed to act. Corporations are just doing what they are created to do. And we elect people who are supposed to keep those corporations in check through laws and regulations and setting expectations for what we will tolerate as a company. As we were just talking about, as Mike just said, the sort of underlying goal of gutting the federal government, not only goal, but one of the many goals, is to pay for the tax cuts, which will go largely to those corporate owners, right? And people who are very wealthy people already working in those corporations, running those corporations, and benefiting from corporate, the lack of oversight and the reduction in the oversight being conducted by government, right? Because it's government's job to keep those corporations in check. So as much as we want to demonize corporations, the only bodies we can hold accountable are the ones being elected. And that is, to me, where our power lies.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. It's time for a world news break from the BBC, and we will return with the final part of today's program after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. The panel today, Nick Rangel, Mike Spain, and Mark Whitman. You can join us by emailing panel at WAMC.org. Let us discuss the latest from... Go ahead, Nick.
I did want to follow up on the previous writer. I do think that people can have a huge impact on the behavior of corporations by changing their spending habits, and that that is the strongest message that a collective of people can have towards where corporations are going to change behaviors other than the behavior of electeds. So you know, impact the behavior of electeds. You impact who is elected, but you also impact where you spend your dollars. And like my mom now goes to Costco like 50 miles away or wherever it is.
Because they kept their DEI in place.
Because they kept their DEI commitment to just fairness. That's mm-hmm. all it is. Just a commitment to fairness. But they kept their commitment to fairness. And so my mom will drive and go, you know, bulk up at Costco as David Gustine was talking about earlier, I think. But so I do want to acknowledge that that is a really powerful way to change the behavior of corporations.
Right. Let us go now to the latest from the Russia-Ukraine war. The Trump administration has paused intelligence sharing with Ukraine alongside a military aid freeze. This from the New York Times. Part of a pressure campaign to force the Ukrainian government to cooperate with the White House's plans to end the country's war with Russia. A U.S. official said the military... targeting information will no longer be shared with Ukraine. A senior Ukrainian official said that the pause would make it more difficult to strike Russian forces, but that Kyiv's military does have access to other satellite imagery. The CIA director John Ratcliffe and the national security advisor Michael Waltz both confirmed the pause in intelligence support, but suggested it could be short-lived if Ukraine quickly came back to the negotiating table. Mark.
Well, this isn't a helpful development. By the way, should we start calling this the war of Russia and the United States against Ukraine? I'm just wondering, given where our administration starts.
Seems a fair question.
There's a great scene in the movie And Justice for All with Al Pacino. He's sending his client, who's a defendant. I think Pacino in the case was a public defender in the movie. He's sending him in to be sentenced, and he puts an Oreos cap on the guy and says, look, you need to wear this before the judge while you're being sentenced. And the guy takes the cap off and says, I'm not kissing no judges. Don't hit the button, but you get the word.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Pacino puts it back on and says, I'm not asking you to kiss it. I just want you to rub it a little. And frankly, I've told this story to a lot of clients who were humiliated in negotiations. I also tell clients, by the way, if you're not thrown out of the room in contentious negotiations at least twice, you're going to be before we get to a deal. So don't worry the first and even the second time it happens. So I took Trump's dismissal of Zelensky, although it is stomach-churning from a geopolitical and ethical standpoint, from a negotiating standpoint, I took it at what it was, a negotiating ploy. Zelensky now seems to have come back. And if I were advising him, so long as this comports with what's acceptable in terms of the political view of him and his home country, I would tell him, start getting your suit tailored for the next visit to the White House. I would also tell him, let's invent a big gold shiny medal that you can give to Trump and to J.D. Vance to thank them officially, make them part of the Legion of Ukraine. I mean, I really would tell him, look, I don't want you to feel like you're selling yourself out. Don't kiss it. But you're going to have to rub it to optimize what we're doing here. The concern to me of the lack of intelligence sharing is not only the fact that that is really detrimental, more so in the short term than most of the armaments that were stopped. The air defense missiles are a big issue because those are defending civilians, and Ukraine's already had to husband them quite carefully. But now that they can't target far into the other side of the contact lines, Russia's got the ability, just as spring is coming now, to amass more forces on the other side and to move up some of their firing positions, which is going to be detrimental to the Ukrainians. The issue for Ukraine is you started to come back. You wrote the letter before the speech to join Congress and sort of did what you need to or did what you started to need to get back into graces. But Trump is still bringing down the hammer on you, right? He's brought down a second hammer. They have got to work through back channel negotiations and figure out what he wants that you can give and give as much of it as they can. I mean, that's just the political realities of this situation. You can carp all you want about what Trump is doing vis-a-vis Russia and the rest of it, but Ukraine's lifespan as a real country is much shorter without the United States than it is with, so you need to take pretty reasonable actions here. My concern is if what Zelensky and the Ukrainians have done so far hasn't cut it, it suggests that they don't have effective back channels or that they're not reliable and they're not getting the message as to what needs to be done to make the situation better. And they and the Europeans need to work really hard to develop that very carefully. I also think there's a bit of an illusion that the Europeans can sort of step up magically. It just can't happen quickly enough to be an effective deterrent against the Soviet Union. So I've talked previously about how what just a profound geopolitical mistake this is. Again, Putin sees the peace deal as a continuation of the war. He sees it as a step forward. He's going to reload and he's going to do something else. He has to, both, but if nothing else, because of the internal pressures within his country and in this Orwellian world that he lives in. Trump sees it as a fait accompli that's going to make him, you know, eligible for a Nobel Peace Prize. So there's that misperception. But the Ukrainians and the Europeans need to figure this out as best they can.
But you know, putting a suit on and putting a gold plaque around J.D. Vance and all that, that's just optics. Trump, I don't think in this case, is just looking for that. He's shilling for Putin. I mean, he doesn't disagree with Putin. He sees it from Putin's perspective, and he aligns with Putin. I think when you said earlier on that this is, should be called the war between, Ukraine and the U.S. and Putin, it's almost to that level by what Trump has done. I don't think cosmetics and appearances and, you know, kowtowing in public to Trump is going to get Zelensky what he wants. I can't see how that will move the dial.
But look, first of all, I would try it. Are you saying he's never going to get what he wants? Because then we've got an even more profound problem. And I would throw medals and tailoring at it before I give up.
I'm not optimistic that he is. I mean, I think that, and I know you're right how unrealistic it is for Europe to step in quickly, the European Union and the allies in Europe to step up and fill the gap. They can't. They can't quickly, and they can't sustainably. Putin knows that, and Trump knows that. And I think that it's up to the U.S. Congress to take action.
So I don't disagree that Ukraine is in real trouble if they can't figure out how to work with the current administration. But I think what's interesting in the background is the impact that showing their hand is having on SpaceX Starlink satellites. So I had been kind of looking at this a couple of years ago when Starlink began sort of proliferating satellites into Ukraine. And there were these contracts under the previous administration to use Starlink for these satellite purposes for intelligence gathering, but also as a provider. And the contracts that we engaged in then, because it gives Elon Musk a tremendous amount of power and access that now he's bringing into a new administration. And I think that this like intelligence gathering piece is like sort of alerting the rest of the world that there is a danger here that they need to have a plan for. So like the stocks for Starlink have dropped, and stocks for the French company, what's it called?
I don't know.
Eutelsat.
Sorry.
have gone up in just the last like 2 days because Europe is really trying to find a way to like find its own path towards its own security and away from the American dominance in that field. And a lot of that is tied up in how we're dealing with Ukraine.
This is from NPR this morning. European leaders are gathering in Brussels today for the latest emergency summit called to bolster security for Ukraine amid questions about U.S. support for the country and their own security. There is new urgency for the effort after President Trump paused military supplies and intelligence sharing with Ukraine this week. So of course, keep an eye on what results from that.
The Europeans have been behind for decades. they need to get this clown car of leaders turned into somebody who looks like Winston Churchill post-haste. I mean, that's the effective way to conduct themselves. They are not, again, I'm being a little bit amoralistic in my evaluation of who's responsible for what, but taking Trump's vision of the world as the accepted premise puts the onus on Europe to start acting with a lot more efficiency and effectiveness than they have historically, even despite the fact that they can't get all the way to providing a substitute for the United States. The problem, but the substitute of the United States, the problem is even if there were a plan and Europe put forces in Ukraine, without this, without U.S. support, Russia can wipe them out. And if that were to happen, imagine the degradation of the security of Europe and the world that would result from that happening. That would be so incredibly costly. And by the way, I get what Vladimir Zelensky said in, I think it's the third language that he speaks behind Ukrainian and Russian, and maybe English is his third language, that Trump and J.D. Vance were so quick to jump on when he said the United States will feel it. Donald Trump took that occasion to distort what he said as if he was being told what he should feel, as what his emotional response should be, and acted the offended flower.
Right.
But what Zelensky meant was, it'll get to your shores, buddy, and you've seen it historically happen so many times. It's going to happen, and so.
Do you think if you do this, quote unquote, for Putin, that he'll stop asking for things?
Right. How long's the ocean keep you safe under these circumstances? And again, but let's get back to.
But that was disrespectful.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it was. Look, it was. You know, again, if I weren't advising Putin, I still would. If I were advising Zelensky, I would still tell him, look, that wasn't an optimal – that was understandable, not optimal reaction. But you've got to – Europe's got to get its act together, and there are a lot of – there's some easy things it can do. Like I said, it has to stop looking like a clown car, and it's got to look more like Winston Churchill over there. Or Charles de Gaulle. I mean, although he's a little even more problematic character, but you pick who you want.
Mark, I was just showing the newest headline from a few hours ago is that there are plans to deport the Ukrainian people who are here in the U.S. legally and revoke their immigration status back to Ukraine.
Yeah, the one thing I can't solve for, and I literally am be thrilled if some listener can explain this to me, is what is Trump's relationship with Russia? I have said, and I think it's true, you just have to assume that he Trump, is by and large doing their bidding. And another panelist, and I won't say who because I don't want – they can't defend their argument here, but said, well, and it is true that we allowed them to – we allowed Ukraine to have Stinger missiles to fight back, and we also did some other things that weren't in Russia's interest. I still think those can be explained as sort of bait in the con, if you will. And I don't have a better explanation for why Trump and Putin are so aligned. I can't figure it out.
Listeners often write in and say that Putin is funding Trump everything. I know. I don't know if it's true, but that is, you said, if listeners could write in and explain, that is something that I've been reading.
Back
from
to Alan Chartok days, I used to respond to his assertion of collusion with some suspicion. I wish I hadn't. I think he was right. I just can't figure out why.
Anna writes in and says, you're all talking as if the future is predictable. The world's environmental upheavals may well make the future a very different scenario, which few people seem to take into consideration as we try to grapple with the current melee.
And maybe that asteroid will hit us.
Mark?
2034. Or 2034.
I appreciate the inherent uncertainty in our world, particularly given what's happening with the environment.
Get on your mic, bub.
I appreciate the assessment of uncertainty in the world, particularly given what's happened with our environment. I still think you gotta, if you're the Ukrainians and or the Europeans and you take Trump as a given, you've gotta figure out what sober reaction you take so as to maximize your attenuated security at this point.
Mike or Nick? Head's shaking.
No, I'm just trying to figure out what the relationship of Trump and Putin is. And I think he just likes to think of himself as a powerful Trump and a powerful person like Putin and navigates to people like him and Kim Jong-un and Xi and other, you know, Viktor Orban. It's his class that he likes, and that's...
I mean, it also may just be that he's embarrassed that this deal isn't sealed up already because he assumed that he could just, you know, say this is done and Zelensky would just fall in line. And now he's been embarrassed by him in a way. And so now he, you know, this is kind of taking center stage in a way that I don't think he intended it to.
Thank you all for a thoughtful discussion. We are out of time for this morning. The panel today has been Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, though all opinions are her own. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. All of you also representing your own opinions. That's the show.
Yes.
Congressional Corner is next.